Hey, Harry.
I'm going to call this hearing of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 20th, 2024. We do have a quorum present. The first item on the agenda is the minutes from February 15th. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Curran.
So moved, Chair. Thank you.
Representative Curran moves the minutes of February 15th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. First thing on our agenda today is a presentation by the judicial branch. If you guys want to come on up. Members, there is a copy in your packets of what's on the slides on the screens. And Mr. Shorba, go ahead and introduce yourself and go ahead with your presentation. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vice Chair Frazier, Lead Scott, and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Jeff Shorba, and I have the honor of being the State Court Administrator for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. I am pleased to provide you today with an update on the investments you made to the Judicial Branch last session and to seek your support for our fiscal year 24-25 supplemental budget and policy request. The Judicial Branch's mission is to provide justice through a system that assures equal access for the fair and timely resolution of cases and controversies. The importance of our work is reflected in Article 1, Section 8 of the Minnesota Constitution, which promises every person in our state is entitled to access justice freely, promptly, and without delay. And the judicial officers and staff who serve in the judicial branch are tasked with upholding that promise. Not only do our courts serve under this constitutional obligation, but we also have the responsibility to deliver and pay for many different types of services pursuant to Minnesota statute. Under Minnesota statute 480.182, the Minnesota judicial branch is required to pay for mandated services, including court interpreters, forensic examination costs, jury program costs, among others. And you'll hear a little bit more about the funding of these costs later in my presentation. Our courts are funded almost entirely through legislative appropriation. All of the revenue we collect through court fines and fees is deposited in the state's general fund or to local government or other statutorily mandated programs. We don't retain any of that revenue. We depend on your appropriation to fund the vital work of our judiciary. Our current biennial budget for fiscal year 24 and 25 is approximately $882 million, and that's equal to roughly 1.4% of our state general fund. On behalf of the judicial branch, I would like to thank you for the significant investment in the judicial branch last session. On this slide, we've detailed the funding provided to the judicial branch last session. We generously received approximately $85 million in ongoing funding and approximately $15 million in one-time funding. With those appropriations, we were able to raise staff and judge salaries to be more competitive with the public sector market, maintain four treatment courts that were funded through expiring federal grants, address our mandated services budget deficit, which we'll talk about more in a minute, enhance courtroom technology to support hybrid and remote hearings, reduce the pandemic case backlog, and sustain increases to contract interpreter payment rates. This historic appropriation to the state's judiciary has put our courts on solid financial footing, and we are really grateful to the legislature and governor for the support last session. Thanks in large part to the legislature's support, we've made significant progress on eliminating the pandemic-era backlog of felony and gross misdemeanor cases. I am pleased to report that as of last week, our district courts have eliminated 98% of the pandemic backlog, and the backlog that once stood at 13,000 cases is down to 298 cases. In total, 77 of our 87 district courts have reached their backlog goal, along with 5 of our 10 judicial districts. We want to give particular credit to the great work of our judges and court staff, as well as our statewide justice partners, for this remarkable progress. I would now like to turn your attention to the Judicial Branch FY24-25 supplemental budget request. The budget request is focused on helping our courts address some of the key challenges facing our judiciary at this moment. As I go through these next slides, I will highlight some of these key challenges and talk about how our budget request aims to address those issues. The first three challenges I will mention all focus on how the judicial branch delivers some of the statutorily mandated services I mentioned earlier. And I'll start with meeting the increasing need for psychological and psychiatric services in our district courts. The judicial branch is responsible for the cost of providing psychological examinations for civil commitment, criminal competency, and criminal responsibility evaluations. Our psychological psychiatric examiner services program within the Minnesota Judicial Branch provides the courts with skilled and qualified examiners to conduct these evaluations. Our courts are facing some significant pressures in this area, including a dramatic increase in the need for psychological and psychiatric services in our courts. Between fiscal year 20 and fiscal year 23, the number of civil and criminal exams increased by more than 140%. In addition, we're facing a shortage of qualified forensic examiners to meet the demand for these examinations. That shortage is exacerbated by the fact that the hourly payment rate we offer for their services is not competitive with other public sector entities. Today, our courts are paying examiners $125 an hour, while at the same time, the Department of Human Services is offering $225 an hour for commitment appeal panel examinations, the same group of examiners. During last year's budgeting process, we asked the legislature to provide roughly $2 million in ongoing annual funding to address the rising cost of providing these statutorily mandated services. The final budget bill, however, only provided $1.5 million per year, and it was one-time funding for fiscal year 24 and 25. So for our supplemental budget request this session, we are seeking $14.57 million in ongoing annual funding to help us meet the rising demand for these mandated services, address the long-term deficit in this program, and increase examiner payment rates from $125 per hour to $225 per hour to ensure we can compete and attract qualified examiners to accept work with our courts.
Mr. Schober, I'm going to have you pause right there. It's a presentation about where things are with the courts, but it also we do have the bill in front of us. So I'm going to go ahead and move House File 3872 so it is in front of us because that's what you're speaking to right now. So members, there will be time for questions at the end, and I want to make sure we can get through the presentation, but I did want to make sure the bill is in front of us and that it's clear that this is what you're speaking to in the bill. So go ahead, Mr. Schorba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The next item in our supplemental budget request relates to another statutorily mandated service, ensuring access to court interpreters. The Minnesota Judicial Branch Court Interpreter Program ensures that people who cannot speak English or are deaf or hard of hearing have equal access to participate in cases in Minnesota state courts. Given the changing demographics of our state, we have seen a sharp rise in the need for court interpreters in recent years. In fact, similar to the growing need for forensic examiners, our need for interpreters has increased from 23,000 events, court interpreter events in 2020, to 46,000 in 2023. So it's doubled. At the same time, it is vital that the judicial branch continues to offer competitive payment rates to ensure the availability of contract court interpreters. Last session, the legislature provided funding that helped us, along with some internal policy changes, to increase payment rates for spoken language interpreters up to $65 per hour for the most qualified interpreters. We believe that in order to remain competitive with our public sector peers, we need to further increase those payment rates. In total, our budget request seeks $1.5 million per year in ongoing funding to help us meet the rising demand for court interpreters and to ensure that our payment rates for court interpreters remain competitive. If this funding is approved, we'll be able to increase the payment rates for certified spoken language interpreters to $75 per hour. The next item in our supplemental budget request relates to juries and ensuring that our juries remain representative of the communities they serve in and that jurors have a positive experience when fulfilling this important civic duty. Minnesota has a strong jury program that meets the best practice recommendations from the National Center for State Courts. However, there is still room to improve the overall juror experience. This funding will address a couple of critical operating needs by ensuring the judicial branch can continue to meet Minnesota's constitutional right to a jury trial in a timely and efficient manner. The requested funding increases would be primarily aimed at increasing the juror per diem and mileage rates to alleviate financial hardship associated with jury duty. Our proposal would increase juror per diem from $20 per day to $100 per day to align with a statewide average of the minimum wage paid for an 8-hour workday, $122 for 8 hours in Minneapolis, $120 in St. Paul, and $87 in the rest of the state. Mileage reimbursement would be increased to match the new higher federal mileage rate. Mileage reimbursement would increase from 54 cents per mile to 65.5 cents per mile. The statewide jury program hopes that by improving the overall juror experience, the court will see increased reporting rates and improved jury representativeness. In addition, the requested funding would allow the judicial branch to expand vicarious trauma services to jurors. National research has found that post-trial anxiety, guilt, and vicarious trauma are among the leading causes of juror dissatisfaction. With this funding, the Minnesota Judicial Branch would begin development of a statewide program to deliver vicarious trauma services to jurors upon request. The Minnesota Judicial Branch would contract with a mental health services vendor to offer virtual therapy sessions to Minnesota jurors who have served on a jury trial. In total, we are seeking $10.02 million per year in ongoing funding to improve the juror experience in Minnesota. Our final two budget items relate to the security of our courts and the safety of those who work in and visit the state's county courthouses. And I'll start with protecting the cybersecurity of our state's judiciary. I'm sure I don't have to tell members of this committee that cybercrimes, especially against public institutions, have increased dramatically in recent years. The strength and security of the judicial branch technology infrastructure is one of the branch's highest priorities. This request addresses necessary hardware and software infrastructure needed to strengthen this effort. The Minnesota Judicial Branch maintains an array of confidential and sensitive data, and protecting and safeguarding that data is crucial. Our cybersecurity program works to ensure the confidentiality, integrity, and availability of this data through a carefully coordinated protection network, which provides the judicial branch the necessary flexibility to protect against increasingly sophisticated cyber attacks. There have been several recent cyber attacks on courts around the country. That includes a cyber attack against the Kansas court system, which shut down their state's case management system and public access applications for over 3 months, forcing their courts to work almost entirely on paper during that time. There have been similar significant attacks targeting courts in Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Fulton County, Georgia. We are seeking $1.75 million in annual funding to enhance and strengthen our cybersecurity program. That funding will be used to purchase advanced cybersecurity monitoring services, implement enhanced cybersecurity monitoring tools, and update older software to more securely manage access to court data. The final piece of our supplemental budget request aims to make our county courthouses safer for those who work and visit those facilities. In 2016 and 2021, the Minnesota Legislature provided one-time funding for the Safe and Secure Courthouse Initiative. This is a competitive grant program overseen by the Chief Justice that provides matching grants to counties to fund courthouse safety and security improvements. In total, the legislature has previously provided $1.5 million in funding for this program in previous years, which has funded courthouse improvements in 57 counties. The branch surveyed Minnesota courthouses again in 2022, identifying significant ongoing safety and security needs across the state. The survey recognized disparities across the state in areas of point of entry screenings, access control systems, use of security camera systems, and access to training and emergency preparedness exercises. Given these significant security needs, we're asking the legislature to provide a $500,000 one-time appropriation to allow us to fund another round of grants through this initiative. Like the previous rounds of grants, the Chief Justice would establish an advisory panel of justice partners and county government officials to develop grant criteria, accept applications, and make grant awards. Counties would be required to provide a dollar-for-dollar match for its grant award in either cash or in-kind services. With this funding, it is anticipated that the advisory committee will meet in the summer and fall of 2024, and the grant solicitation process will begin by January 2025. In total, the judicial branch is seeking $56.2 million in new permanent funding in fiscal year 24-25, which is a 6.37% increase over our base biennial budget. In addition, we are seeking $500,000 in one-time funding for courthouse safety and security grants. In addition to our supplemental budget requests, the bill before you today contains a number of policy changes to help streamline court operations and protect court users. So allow me briefly to summarize those provisions. Section 1 of the bill establishes a minimum amount for interest-bearing accounts. Minnesota statute currently requires condemnation proceeds to be deposited into an interest-bearing trust account within one day of receipt. This requires significant, quick action to set up the account, and very often nominal or no interest accrues before the funds are distributed. The proposal recommends a minimum of $10,000 to be established before requiring deposit into an interest-bearing trust account to warrant the amount of time and effort needed to meet this statutory requirement. Sections 2 and 3 of the bill allows court administration to notify DVS of request to suspend a driver's license due to an unsatisfied civil judgment via system-to-system integration rather than creating certified documents to send through the mail or email. A similar process has been used for many years to notify DVS of request to suspend driver's licenses in criminal cases. Section 4 and Section 10 of the bill would allow the judicial branch to use forensic examiners licensed by other jurisdictions to provide remote forensic examiner services in Minnesota. We view this as a key way our state can efficiently and effectively meet the rapidly increasing demand for psychological and psychiatric examinations. Sections 5 and 11 of the bill would allow courts to serve court-generated notices by publishing them on the Minnesota Judicial Branch website rather than as statute currently requires a qualified newspaper. There are a variety of court notices and orders that require service by publication. For example, if a harassment restraining order cannot be personally served, then the petitioner can request that the order be served by publication at the court's expense. With the advancement of technology and expanded access to the internet, service by publication today results in little to no actual notice to court users. It does, however, come at a significant cost to the state taxpayers who fund our courts. The branch spends approximately $244,000 per year on publishing court notices. We believe that publication via our judicial branch website would be more effective, efficient, and less expensive. Section 6 of the bill is a technical change that would exempt the judicial branch from notice requirements in the Revenue Recapture Act. Today's statute requires courts to send out revenue recapture notices for past due court fines and fees. However, the statutory language of those notices includes information that does not pertain to debts owed to the judicial branch. This, of course, leads to confusion on the part of court users. Instead, we prefer to use our own court forms and notices to inform users that their case may be referred to revenue recapture. Section 7 and 9 of the bill updates the service requirements for orders for protection and harassment restraining orders to reflect the fact that most OFP and HRO hearings are now held remotely rather than in person in a courtroom. Currently, when a respondent appears at an OFP or HRO hearing remotely and an order is issued, court administration sends the order to the sheriff's office to personally serve it on the respondent. However, it can take several days to effectuate service and for the court to receive proof of service from the sheriff's office. There are also situations where the respondent is not able to be personally served or intentionally evades service. This has led to law enforcement refusing to enforce active OFP and harassment orders even when the respondent appeared at the hearing and is aware of all the terms and conditions of the order. This compromises the safety of the protected party. So under a proposed statutory change, respondents who appear for a hearing remotely would be notified of the OFP or HRR order at the hearing, and the order would be served by electronic means or first-class mail as ordered by the court. Finally, Section 8 of the bill aims to address a serious issue pertaining to jury service. Currently, state statute does not contain language addressing differentiated work schedules or work shifts for employers and employees. Jury managers have observed and received complaints from the courts and legal community of jurors working night shifts or performing other full-time work during jury service, finding it difficult to remain attentive during jury service. The traditional workforce has changed significantly over the years, and more potential jurors work alternate shifts than in the past. This has increased the number of reports of jurors falling asleep and are lacking attention in Minnesota courtrooms. Jury managers across the state report employers often require off-shift employees to work an alternate work shift or work all night before reporting to jury service. Jurors themselves also express concern about being able to pay attention without the opportunity to sleep after working night shifts or performing other full-time work during jury service. The language in this bill would prohibit employers from requiring employees to work night shifts, performing other full-time work or alternate work schedules when that employee is participating in jury service. Maryland, Virginia, New York, Nebraska, Colorado, and Tennessee have already enacted laws directing employers to release individuals working these kind of shifts. We believe this would be an important step to both improve the jury experience and ensure the fair and timely resolution of cases. So, Chair Becker Finn, members, on behalf of the judicial branch, thank you for your time and attention. This concludes my overview of our supplemental budget request and the various policy provisions in the bill before you today. Thank you for your consideration of this vital request to Minnesota's judiciary. Thank you.
I'll be happy
to answer questions, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Shorba. As we know, we don't have the February forecast, and I don't know if I'm going to be allocated any money to spend. So, which is why we're not voting on anything today. We'll be laying this over. I did want to note that we do have a new Chief Justice. I have met with Chief Justice Hudson a couple times now, and certainly welcome and congratulate her on her appointment as Chief. And it's been a pleasure to get to work with kind of a different new day in the judicial branch. I know she couldn't be here today, but did want to note she's been good to get to work with her, and I know there'll be some slight changes in the way we present things, and just because we've got different leadership. So also wanted to note that Callie Lehman, former Republican staffer, but well loved by all of us, has left us to go work for the judicial branch. So it's good to see Callie back in this committee room. We do have a couple questions, and I have a couple questions as well, if other folks don't ask them first. So first we got Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yeah, I'm sure that the catch up on the backlog from the pandemic is because you got new help in your office.
Absolutely.
Anyway, we're trying to work over here to forgive you for stealing her away, but we get it. So. And mostly my questions were regarding the forensic examiners, about how many people are in that pool that you have to choose from.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, I believe there's about 100 people who we draw from as contractors. We also have in the 4th Judicial District, Hennepin County, some staff forensic examiners who mostly work in Hennepin County to do that job. Similar to court interpreters, we have some staff, and then we mostly rely on contractors.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious because that's quite a jump per hour. $100 more per hour seems like a lot. And but do you have in here anywhere, and maybe you mentioned it in your presentation, I missed it, but how many more cases, maybe that was the interpreters, I think I had those numbers. How many more cases are you seeing that are in need of these forensic examiners, you know, over the last couple of biennium?
Thank you. Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, we have seen between fiscal year 20 and 23 a jump of exams by 140%.
Okay.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a hard number on the number. That's just the percentage,
right? I can certainly get the number if you'd like it.
Okay. Thank you. So my next question, Madam Chair, is just in general, why not ask for all this last year in a budget year?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, we were already asking for a historical amount, and we did ask for money for forensic exams. We were given one-time money. We did ask for money for interpreters. We were given $200,000.
Okay.
But now we are continuing to have a deficit. And when I say a deficit, we have to pay for those costs. And the only way to pay for those costs in the judiciary, we don't have a lot of money set aside for rainy day. We are 90% people. That means we have to either cut back on court staff or cut back on hours. So our court operations are affected by having to pay for these mandated services. So we asked for some last time. Now most of the increase here is going towards increasing the pay. And I agree the contract rate jumping from 125 to 225 is a lot. We wouldn't have asked for that last year until we saw DHS go to 225, and you can just guess where the forensic examiners want to go. Mm-hmm. So that's why this has really become more of a crisis for us in the mandated services area.
And so, Mr. Shorba, on that point, can you remind us what level of education is required to be a forensic examiner?
Yeah, these are generally psychiatrists or psychologists who have a PhD.
Right. So we're not talking about a master's degree. We're talking about psychologists. I don't know if anyone's tried to access therapy, but I mean, the going rate paying out of pocket for even somebody with a master's degree is, I think, upwards of $150 or more right now, at least in the Twin Cities, to my knowledge. So, I mean, it's not surprising. I know we've talked too about whether we actually need people with a doctorate degree to be doing that work. Certainly it's a workforce problem across the board with folks who practice in that area, but I think that's an important thing to note, is that generally a psychiatrist or a psychologist they go to school for a really long time. Representative Scott, further follow-up.
That's it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, both related to the juror experience. And a couple years ago, it was brought to my attention about the jury selection process, and that if someone is a victim themselves of trauma of some sort, let's say sexual assault, we know that, unfortunately, in most cases, people who are a victim of sexual assault want to bury it. They don't want to talk about it. And if they get a little note in the mail saying that, hey, it's your turn to serve jury selection, and they happen to have a case before them that is related to a sexual assault, they might get a letter in the mail from the judge saying, please fill out this questionnaire. And in that questionnaire, it could be, have you been a victim of sexual assault? Did you report it? And the list goes on in all these questions. Being in the position of someone who has been a victim, getting that questionnaire, that can be incredibly re-traumatizing to be forced to go through that process, especially in the top where it says, if you don't fully disclose, you could be in contempt of court and have all of these like threats essentially against them. I was pleased to learn over this last interim in a meeting with Ms. Lehman that the courts actually did publish a document to try to make the process of jury selection more trauma-informed, which I was really excited and grateful for. But since that meeting, I've also gotten more emails from different advocates across the state saying the judges had never heard of that document. And so my first question then is, what effort is underway to make sure that that document is more widely distributed to judges across the state so they're aware of it, to make that process easier on people who are being called to serve on jury duty.
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick, as far as I know, we've done some training for judges, and we are distributing that document to them. It wasn't formal. I think it was an online session that judges could take. But I agree with you. I mean, it's very traumatic for somebody to have to fill out that questionnaire. That's why In the court system, we try to deal with these cases on a case-by-case basis. If you don't want to fill it out and you want to write back and say, I need to be excused for these reasons, then our jury staff will look at that note and will possibly contact you and try to figure out what's going on. But we don't have any way to know, obviously, who's been traumatized, so we don't send them these things, and we can't really do that. We have to call people objectively for jury service. So I think your point is a good one. We should make sure that we are doing as much education as possible of judges.
Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there's a power dynamic in that the courts are being oblivious to. People who are in that position may not feel that they are empowered to say and advocate for themselves that, oh, I just have to say I'm not comfortable, you know, talking about this. I went through this experience. I don't want to talk about that. At the top of that questionnaire, it might say, answer this or else. And that's coming from a powerful institution. And so they may not be able to feel like they can, that they can advocate for their own interest in that. And I would hope that the courts are aware of that, because from my conversations and even right here, it doesn't necessarily sound like they are.
Mr. Sharma.
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick, I'm happy to hear your suggestions for how to deal with that. We are obligated to summon people according, as I mentioned, to objective criteria. If there's something we can be doing to help make it easier, make it less traumatic, put some wording in it, I'm happy to get suggestions either from you or the advocacy community on how to do that. We are open to your suggestions.
What I'm hearing is maybe the language used at the top of that form, you know, those of us who maybe are attorneys or are used to advocating for ourselves when we're not happy with something might be familiar with calling and saying, do I really have to do this? But I think the point is that a lot of folks may not feel like they're in that position. And honestly, I think most folks, when they get something in the mail that's from the court, they're pretty scared right off the bat, because they take it really seriously, which we want folks to take seriously. So I think we could definitely work on this to improve the experience for folks. Any follow-up, Representative Frederick?
Yeah, happy to talk more on that piece. The second piece is just much more of a day-to-day question. Across the state, when people are, you know, get that notification for jury duty, I know that some people have to call in every day to see if they have to report. Other people get text messages. Is there any effort underway to have a standardized statewide system so everyone could just get a text message or some make that process easier?
Mr. Sharma.
Madam Chair, Representative Frederick, there are discussions. You know, we used to be a county-based system, and we still have some remnants of county-based systems. So every judicial district, unfortunately, does it a little different, and some counties do it differently. We are always talking about ways to standardize and use technology in a better way. So I assure you that is one of my ultimate goals. And with your point, Madam Chair, we have a bunch of jury people here, but I don't want to take up another half hour. I could certainly have them come down and talk specifically about the jury practices.
We will note that if our schedule allows at a future date, that may be a topic that's worth delving into deeper.
Absolutely.
Next on the list, I've got Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, Mr. Thorba, thank you for being here today. That perked my ears when you had mentioned something. Right now, we underpay our jurors at $20 a day, I believe it is. And I believe it does need to be adjusted a little bit. But what really perked my ears was when you mentioned it was either Minneapolis-St. Paul or Hennepin-Ramsey at a different rate than the rest of the state. Can you explain why you're looking at doing that?
Mr. Johnson, I think what he was saying is that the number was based on the average, looking at the average statewide. And so he was saying the average of an 8-hour workday at minimum wage in Minneapolis is a little bit higher than the average that you would get paid minimum wage for 8 hours of what the going rate is that folks are being paid minimum wage. So I think he was saying the $100 kind of meets in the middle of where Minneapolis and other parts of the state are. As we know, cost of living is higher in the metro area, and you know, I would love for workers to be paid more across the state, but I think that's what you were saying, is you were advocating $100 across the board regardless of where the juror is located. Representative Johnson.
Chair Becker-Finn, that a little bit to the point that I have. Our county attorneys and our county prosecutors are in trouble right now because of the difference in with the public defenders, what their huge pay raises across the state, a lot of counties, small counties, they're losing their prosecutors to the public defender's office because of the huge pay difference that the state is paying the public defenders compared to what the counties can pay their prosecutors. The increase was based on only the average of 14 counties, mostly in the metro area, for that pay increase, not taking consideration the difference across the state. Now, the state patrol, they give, for those that work, at least it used to be when I was in the sheriff's office and working with the troopers, those that worked in the metro area did get a bump, an adjustment. So I think, so right now our county attorneys are hurting for higher prosecutors because of what we did last year in that huge increase that was done. So I think we have to look at how we do this in a way that is more fair across the state. Because as you mentioned, the cost of living in different parts of the state is different than in the metro area.
Yeah, well, the question before us today is whether we should raise jury pay in the bill before us. A rising tide lifts all ships, and I think it would be great if everybody was paid what they're worth. I will also remind members that we all voted in favor of the bill to fund public defense, which is a constitutionally required thing that we fund. Moving on, Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for coming. So I have a question regarding the safe and secure.
Yeah, Representative Carroll, just that seat at the end of the, if you can move the mic closer just so we, yeah.
So $500,000 for one time, having worked in Hennepin County as an attorney and being subject to various security incidents, that seems rather a modest amount. So I know it's better to grant program. Can you give me an example of what you think would qualify and how much it would be on average?
Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Carroll. So I can give you some examples. I don't have dollar amounts, but some of the examples that people have put in their grant applications, paying for training, paying for someone to come in and help with emergency preparation for how to deal with an emergency, sort of doing a role playing with individuals, paying for bulletproof glass where you might need it, or at least some coverings on glass so that people aren't looking, especially in rural courthouses, looking in the window into a judge's chambers, paying for equipment for screening. This grant won't pay for ongoing costs, so you can't pay for the personnel, but it would pay for one-time costs like that. Doing a security assessment of your whole courthouse. So there are federal entities that will come in and tell you, these are the 20 things you should change. Some of them would be one-time fixes, some would be ongoing. So we're looking at the past way we've done this. At one time, we had a $1 million grant program, then we had a $500,000 grant program. We know we got more applications than we had money. Both times, we came up with this dollar figure of $500,000 based on the last time we did it.
All right.
Thank you.
Representative Niska, and then I've got Representative Feist, and we do have a bunch of other bills we have to move. So, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Fan and Mr. Shorba. I'll ask a bunch of questions. I expect you'd probably
Representative Niska, I will warn you, we don't have time for a bunch of questions, but I'm sure he'll be available afterwards. So
sure,
go ahead.
And that was my point, Chair Becker-Finn, is I'm going to raise kind of a topic where I'm curious about a lot of information, and I expect you probably don't have this necessarily at your fingertips, but you talked about standardizing and leveraging technology, and my experience has been that a lot, at least in civil cases, especially in Hennepin County, a lot of routine motion hearings have moved online, and I was curious, I'm curious generally about sort of the statewide picture of that and the court-wide picture of that in terms of how widespread is the use of virtual hearings, what are the types of cases that's in, how is that helping the courts maybe become more efficient, and are there concerns about that? So that was just a broad topic, and I understand we don't have time to get into all that. You probably don't necessarily have all of that information at your fingertips, but curious about your thoughts on
that. And Mr. Shorba, again, we'll be laying this over, so at the time that we move it forward and we're actually have hopefully a budget target to work with, we can get more into the details there for sure. Mr. Shorba.
Madam Chair, Representative Niska, the Judicial Council has worked very hard to make sure that we are learning lessons from the pandemic, including the use of remote hearings. So I can certainly send you, or Callie can send you, our current policy, which has a presumption for various hearing types of doing them remotely. The judge, of course, can make another decision given circumstances. The council is now working in the criminal area, so we'll present recommendations to the council in June to decide which hearings presumptively will be remote in the criminal area, and those are standard across the state. So I think we're cutting edge in the country of doing that, not just going back to the old way of doing business, but really trying to make sure that we're learning lessons about how to do remote hearings.
Right. That was the level of detail I was looking for.
Got it. Didn't want to get you going here this morning, Representative Niska. Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Shorba. I just wanted to emphasize the importance of court interpreters, and I'm glad to see this request for significant funding. People don't have true access to justice unless they understand the proceedings, and I've heard some alarming anecdotes of reliance on alternatives to the court interpreters that haven't been adequate to ensure that people understand the judicial proceedings. So I just wanted to emphasize that they are so important, and that I hope we have lots of money to give to you. But whatever we have, I just hope that you're looking at prioritizing pay increases for court interpreters. And also, I'm super excited. I've never had jury duty in my whole life, and I have it in June. So all these protections will be there for me. So thank you.
Don't get too excited, Representative Feist. They'll probably screen you out there, but maybe not. I know my partner's been called for jury duty several times, and when they found out who their spouse was, they got kicked from the jury pool. So, you know, you never know when you know a lot of attorneys, you get screened out for stuff. But I'm glad you're excited about it. We should all be excited about jury duty. And just one more thing I'll just note is I know that we've had conversations, and I've had conversations with the Chief Justice, but for the public's knowledge, we are aware of the issues around access to MNSIS and court documents that some of our prosecutors and folks who work in the system, that there's some changes that had to be made due to some software upgrades, and that there is a work group that's going to be put together so that we can get back to a place where hopefully that access is easier for folks. So just wanted to note that for the record. We did not have any public testifiers signed up who are here, but I realize I didn't ask if there are any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill. Okay. Yep. Please go ahead, and we'll give you about just a couple minutes so we can move on. But again, this bill will be before us again when we actually move it. So go ahead and please introduce yourself.
Thank you for having me, Chair Becker Finn, Vice Chair Frazier, and members of this committee. My name is Maria Landa Cabrera, and I'm a certified court interpreter. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Certified Court Interpreters, a non-unionized labor organization of over 100 interpreters concerned about equal access and the critical role that interpreters play in a fair and impartial judicial system. We serve as vital conduits of communication, enabling all to fully comprehend their rights, responsibilities, and the proceedings before them. We facilitate equal participation, allowing every voice to be heard and understood. We uphold the core tenets of justice and equality. The legislature must invest in robust interpreter services to guarantee that every individual receives fair treatment and an opportunity to access justice. I'm also here today to urge this committee to approve MJB's supplemental budget request. Amongst them is an increase on the hourly rate to $75. At the same time, please understand that this request is a beginning, not a conclusion. To that end, we are also requesting that MJB reconvene the Interpreter Advisory Committee as a standing committee. Today, we have no representation within the MJB. The dissolution of the Interpreter Advisory Committee has contributed to outcomes including, as this committee is certainly aware, the current interpreter work stoppage, now in its seventh week. Why did this stoppage occur? MJB will state that the stoppage occurred despite an increase from $56 to $65 per hour taking effect last month. Meanwhile, MJB terminated billable travel time and reduced the hourly remote interpreting rate by more than half. This is, by every means of measurement, one step forward and two steps back. One step forward and two steps back during low fill rates. But there is no shortage of court-certified interpreters. Rather, there is a lack of incentive for us to work in the courts as meaningful work, reasonable compensation, and fair labor practices can be found outside of the courts. One step forward and two steps back for equal access to our courts. Eliminating travel time will result in serious consequences for your deaf, deaf-blind, and hard-of-hearing constituents because remote interpreting presents unique issues. As well, rural courthouses are unlikely to find spoken language or American Sign Language interpreters to show up in person. The current hourly rate represents only 68% of 1997 purchasing power. While this legislature enacted historic protections and benefits for labor in 2023, we received no such windfall. One step forward and two steps back. We spend years honing our skills. Few interpreters who take the certification exam pass it. We are professionals and deserve to be recognized as such. A seat at the table is a fair and reasonable request. Thank you for your attention to these crucial issues. Let us reaffirm our commitment to linguistic diversity and equal access to Minnesota courts for all. Thank you very much for your past support as well.
Yeah. Thank you for your testimony. Any other members of the public wishing to testify? All right. With that, members, I will lay over House File 3872. Next up, we've got House File 1989, Moeller's version in front of us.
No music? Where's the music?
Where is the music? We missed the boat on that one. Representative Moeller, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before I do that, I have the DE4, and I'm wondering, are you ready for it?
Representative Moeller, first, if you want to move House File 1989, Moeller's version, in front of us, then we can move to the DE.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe the motion is to refer this back to the Commerce Committee.
Correct. All right. So bill is in front of us. Representative Moeller, would you like to move the DE4?
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you.
All right. Representative Moeller, please. I believe this is just an author's amendment to get it in the shape you would like, and then you'll speak to the bill after that. So all those in favor of the DE4, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Moeller, begin again.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. So the genesis of this bill was really my experience being a Swiftie and trying to get tickets to the Eras Tour. And it wasn't just me, obviously. There were a lot of people who had difficulties I think the amount of productivity in the U.S. that day with people trying to get tickets while they were at work or at school was probably really poor. And speaking to other people who had similar experiences, including folks who had set a limit on a budget, and then when they got to the end, they were finally excited to get in to the line and get their tickets, saw enormous fees that were tacked on to the price of the ticket. And for those of you who have purchased tickets in these ticketing platforms before, like Ticketmaster, you know that when you select a ticket, you often don't see those fees until you get to the very end, and then you have 2 minutes to make a decision or however much, or you're going to lose your spot. And so some of those practices really came to my attention as a result of this. There's been some federal discussion and movement on fairness and ticketing as well. And so I started working on this bill last year. And by the way, the number House File 1989 was actually not intentional, if you can believe that. It wasn't a total fluke, I'll just say that. But I started working on this bill and realized that there were a lot of stakeholders that needed to be engaged in this discussion. So I did press pause on it last year. Senator Klein has been working with me on it, and we have talked to numerous stakeholders, not only the ticketing industry itself, but many different venues, all kinds of different entertainment aspects, and resellers, sports teams, all of that, and taken in a lot of feedback. So the DE4 reflects all of those conversations. And I'll just note, those conversations are ongoing. Many of these things affect things that will go in the Commerce Committee when the bill goes back there. But just for those in the room who are here on this bill, they know we're still continuing to work on some of those aspects. But in general, the bill has the same consumer protections that we had when we presented it the first time. It has all-in pricing, so to make it clear that when you're purchasing a ticket, you know what the total cost of the ticket is up front, and not when you have a minute left to make a decision or lose your spot forever. It bans speculative ticketing, and that's the process where tickets go on sale before they're actually even offered to anyone else, or they're presented as being on sale, and those tickets aren't even available yet. So we're going to ban that. We're going to prevent misleading practices on resale sites that make the consumer think that they're buying it from, you know, the actual seller, the original seller. And I'll just note, too, that aspects of this bill have come from other states like Nevada and New York. But the section that is most relevant to this committee are the data provisions in Subdivision 5. And this subdivision is allowing the Commissioner of Commerce to request information about the usage of illegal bots on these platforms. Those bots are illegal. We just want some information about when we want Commerce to be able to get that information about when those types of bots are being used. It's civil investigative data, and the commissioner may share it with the attorney general, any not public data. So really that is what's before this committee, but I'm happy to answer questions about the bill. Thank you.
Are there any members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? You would need to speak now. All right, seeing none, we'll move on to member discussion. Representative Niska, are you going to out yourself as a Swiftie?
Chair Becker-Finn, no, I'm not planning to. I did have a fun encounter with my son who thought it was really funny when I was listening to Taylor Swift Essentials just to understand what the big deal was. For the record, I don't believe you that House File 1989 is unintentional, but we don't have to.
You'll never know who the mastermind is.
Representative Moeller, my question for you is actually about something that would be in this committee's jurisdiction but appears absent, which is the private right of action in a previous version. And I just want to clarify, because is the intent that this is outside of the Attorney General 8.31 statute? And if maybe there should be some clarification about whether there is a private right of action in this bill through that. Because just if we passed it the way it is, I think there would be at least some ambiguity in our overall statutory scheme about that.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for the question. So you might be aware of a Minnesota Supreme Court decision that came out at the end of 2023. It's called Finling versus Group Health Plan, and that opinion says that an individual can bring a private right of action under 831, the Attorney General section. So that's why we took it out of the bill after that decision came out. We believe that this does fall under the purview of Chapter 831 and then the civil right of action that goes along with that.
Somebody else has access to Westlaw. Representative Niska.
Thanks. That's very clarifying, because the way it's written, it's all about the Commissioner of Commerce. And so I was curious as to what the intent was from that perspective. Thank you.
All right. Any other discussion? Oh, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I saw this bill come and I'm like, oh my gosh. So as a fan of the world champion Kansas City Chiefs, had my fill of Swifties, okay? I've had my fill of let's just not take your eyes off the ball, literally, and focus it on Taylor Swift and the very expensive box so that she was always seated in. But anyway, I digress. So Section 5, I'm still trying to – I'm not a tech person, okay? So could you explain, like, in layman's terms what this bot stuff means in relation to this bill? And are other states – do other states have this kind of practice as well? Thank you.
Representative Scott, why do you got to be so mean? Representative Moeller, to the question about bots.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Scott, I can tolerate it. Sorry. To answer the second part of your question first, I'm not aware of other states that do this. One of the things that we were hearing is that bots are being used frequently on these platforms, and there are certainly technologies that the ticket sellers, the online marketplaces, are constantly trying to keep up with them and eliminate those bots. That's what we're told. But we're also been informed that it's rare that that use of bots ever gets investigated, reported, anything like that. I think a lot of that might be coming from overseas. There might be certainly understandable reasons why that's hard to investigate or put an end to it. But we want someone to be able to figure out, like, who is using bots at least, or how often are they being used in these the online ticket marketplace. So that's really what we're trying to get at with this language.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Any further member discussion? Closing comments, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think I'm done with the lyric references now, but I'll just say that whether you're a Taylor Swift fan or not, or there's another artist you really want to see, or a sporting event like Caitlin Clark coming to play the Gophers next week, regardless of what kinds of tickets you're trying to get, you as a consumer and all of Minnesotan consumers deserve transparency in that process and fairness in that process. And that's what we're trying to achieve. And hopefully you can support my bill and vote yes. Thank you.
Yeah, I know this is delicate, but there really is no bad blood. And with that, Representative Mueller renews her motion that House File 1989 be referred, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Sorry, not sorry. Next up, Representative Finke.
I'm the problem, it's me.
Now let's talk about tree data.
Right.
Welcome to the Judiciary and Civil Law Committee. Representative Finke, would you like to move that House File 3461 be referred to the Environment, Finance, and Policy Committee?
I would.
All right. Representative Finke moves the bill in front of us. Please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and members. I'm very pleased to bring my love of tree policy to the Judiciary Committee this morning. It's a very simple agency bill that would reclassify some survey data in forest industry businesses as private data to get a more comprehensive sense of how our forests and trees are being used. And that's all it does. I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
All right. I've got Mr. John Drimmel. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair, Committee. John Drimmel. I am the State Land Section Manager for DNR Forestry. So all the management that happens in our state forests and other state lands, we're involved in that process. Part of our work is collecting information, as Representative mentioned, from forest product companies each year. We survey a subset of 800 forest product facilities across the state. We partner with the U.S. Forest Service to collect this information. Recently, our responsibilities have increased in that venue, and that's good because we have relationships with these businesses, and we have quicker access to this data. We aggregate that data into a report and make that publicly available. It helps us with our forest planning, and it also helps businesses understand if they want to invest or expand or move to Minnesota. In doing that survey, some worry that, you know, sharing information with DNR, others can find out information about them and gain an advantage. So that becomes a barrier in responding to the survey or in responding, you know, 100% to all the questions. This legislation making that individual mill data information not public helps them, gives them confidence to answer the survey questions honestly and completely, and it would increase the response rate from those businesses. So in doing so, that would help us produce more accurate and reliable forest resource and industry data for our planning and for our businesses. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And I do have one member of the public signed up to testify, Rick Horton. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Rick Horton. I'm the Executive Vice President of Minnesota Forest Industries. We're a trade organization representing the primary wood-consuming mills in the state. Our members transform trees into forest products, wood products that we use every day of our lives. I'm testifying in support of House File 3461. Our industry takes antitrust very seriously. As you're well aware, antitrust laws are designed to promote fair competition in markets and prevent anti-competitive behavior such as price fixing, collusion, and monopolization. Trade associations, by their very nature, bring together competitors to work together on issues of concern for the industry as a whole. And, you know, we simply can't discuss things like markets, prices, wood consumption, and other information that could be used improperly. Therefore, every one of our meetings starts with an antitrust, you know, statement from the very beginning. So the Forest Service has been conducting this timber products output survey for a number of years, and they collect information from my members and other producers on, you know, what wood do they use, how much, where did they get it from, that sort of thing. And, you know, when the federal government does it, they abide by the laws regarding the privacy of that data. The DNR, starting this year, is taking over all of the TPO survey, including, you know, my memberships. And as they were looking at that, they kind of realized that, as you heard, they feel like the privacy portion of that in state statute is inadequate. And it is critical that this survey data be handled very carefully, ensuring compliance with antitrust regulations and safeguarding against any potential misuse that could harm competition in the marketplace. It must be shared only in aggregate and, you know, in a way that facilitates, in a way that does not facilitate collusion and coordination in pricing, market allocation, and anti-competitive practices. And also, if you use the data in aggregate, it protects sensitive and confidential information. It increases the survey response rates, as John stated. If folks feel like they're going to be, you know, this data is going to be used improperly, they're not going to share it.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing none, we'll move on to member discussion, if any. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this seems like a really reasonable bill. And I always struggle with, you know, in Chapter 13, proprietary information is protected, and where do we draw the line? Is this sort of belt and suspenders? And I'm happy to vote for the bill. I do have one question, and I don't know if it's to the gentleman from the DNR or not, but I believe that the federal government also requires a certain amount of data. Maybe the bill author knows this, and then the state government also does. Is there overlap there, or is the federal government getting data that the state government isn't?
Yeah, well, I can answer that.
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Whoever wants to take that, go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Scott. So the Forest Service was in charge of this survey for a number of years, but it was always behind because of manpower shortages and problems they had in acquiring the data, analyzing the data, producing the reports. And so, you know, the most recent one is 3 years old. We want to get that data current because markets are changing all the time, and we're trying to attract new businesses to come to Minnesota, utilize wood that's not being utilized, and help us manage our forests to be more healthy. So having more current data is part of this whole process. So there will not be duplication. The DNR is contracting with the Forest Service to take over this survey for them.
Well, I know with changing climate and things changing faster than every 3 years, that makes a lot of sense. Follow-up, Representative Scott?
No.
All right. With that, Representative Finke, closing comments?
I appreciate your support for this bill.
All right. Representative Finke renews her motion that House File 3461 be referred to the Environment, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank
you. Vice Chair Frazier.
A
last bill on our agenda today. I will note members, Representative Hollins is out sick, so we'll be rescheduling that bill for a different day. So this is the last bill on our agenda today. I know staff updated that, but in case folks are looking at an older agenda. Vice Chair Frazier, would you like to move House File 2400 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee?
This is my motion, Madam Chair.
All right. And then I understand you have an A1 amendment. Do you want to take care of that right away?
That is correct.
All right. Representative Frazier moves the H2400A1 amendment. Do you want to tell us briefly what that amendment does?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward, Madam Chair. Thank you. The A1 amendment provides clarifying language to address concerns raised by the County Attorneys Association. It also changed the effective date to 2024.
Okay. Any discussion to the A1 amendment? All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Frazier, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. House File 2400 stands to address an issue of fundamental injustice present in our current legal system. House File 2400 is a bill that will revise the language governing exception to the two-year statute of limitations in Minnesota Statute 590.01. This bill is not just about legal technicalities. It is about ensuring that individuals who have been wrongly convicted have a chance at justice. As it stands, our current law makes Minnesota one of the most restrictive jurisdictions in the nation and the most restrictive in the Midwest when an individual is seeking to bring forth post-conviction claims based on newly discovered evidence. The requirement that this evidence must demonstrate their innocence by a clear and convincing standard is simply unreasonable. Many cases do not lend themselves to this type of proof, and as a result, people with serious claims are kept in prison and out of court due to a procedural technicality that has nothing to do with the merits of the case. This bill seeks to rectify this injustice by striking a requirement of this high standard. Instead, if an individual has truly new evidence that supports a legally valid claim for relief, they deserve that day in court. This change would bring Minnesota law more in line with other jurisdictions and ensure that individuals with meritorious claims are not unjustly kept out of court. The case of Marvin Haynes serves as a poignant example of why this legislation is crucial. Marvin was wrongly convicted and spent nearly 20 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. It was only through the waiver of the statute of limitations by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office that he was able to have his case considered or reconsidered. We cannot rely on such waivers to ensure justice is served. We need a more reasonable standard in place. I hope we can all support House File 2400 and help bring about a more just legal system for all individuals in Minnesota. Let us ensure that individuals like Marvin Haynes have their shot at justice and are not kept out of the court due to procedural technicalities. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you. And I do have a couple testifiers signed up. First up, I have Andrew Markworth. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Fenn, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you today to speak in support of House File 2400. My name is Andrew Markworth. I am a managing attorney at Great North Innocence Project. We represent individuals who've been wrongfully convicted of crimes and work to promote public policies that prevent and help remedy wrongful convictions. Now, in most cases, most of the time, our criminal justice system does a reasonably good job of making sure we get it right, that if we're going to lock someone up in prison, you know, we can be pretty sure they're guilty. But not always. Sometimes the system gets it wrong. And that's why we need to have post-conviction procedures that allow someone to get back into court where there's new evidence that the conviction is factually or legally defective. And sometimes, through no fault of the defendant, that evidence doesn't come up until years later. And the most basic premise of this bill is that if you have truly new evidence and that could undermine a conviction and it comes to light at any point in time, you should have your day in court. You should get a chance to present that evidence. So this bill, as Representative Frazier explained, would revise the statute of limitations for post-conviction claims based on newly discovered evidence. By way of background, we have a presumptive two-year statute of limitations in Minnesota. There is a menu of exceptions to that two-year limit, including one for newly discovered evidence. The problem is it's just too hard to invoke. That bar is too high and almost never is capable of you very rarely see defendants get above that bar unless you have something like DNA, which just isn't available in most cases. So as Representative Frazier explained, the current standard, the problem is with the current standard that you have to, just to get over the statute of limitations, you have to affirmatively demonstrate innocence by a clear and convincing standard. So why is that a problem? So for one, you have to prove a negative. You know, you're not just showing new evidence that undermines the conviction. You got to affirmatively prove you didn't do something. And you got to do it by a clear and convincing standard, which the lawyers in the room will know is a very high standard. So you're talking about proving a negative. I mean, if imagine someone told you, give me clear and convincing evidence that Bigfoot doesn't exist. Could you do it? I suspect, you know, we would struggle when we're talking about proving a negative. While that standard, it works for DNA cases, it doesn't work in the vast majority of cases. And remember, we're talking here about just getting over the statute of limitations. We're not talking about getting out of prison. We're talking about getting back into court, getting a chance. As Representative Frazier mentioned, our client, Marvin Haynes, is a great example of why we need this change in the law. He spent nearly 20 years in prison, starting when he was 16 years old for a crime he didn't commit. He was convicted based largely on unconstitutional eyewitness procedures. And was convicted even though he didn't match the description of the witness even remotely.
I'll just remind you, he's testifying next, so I'm sure he can speak for himself as well.
And you'll get to hear from him in just a moment. But there are more people like him out there. His case is not one of a kind. There are more people like him who deserve their day in court, and as of today, are being denied justice. So what this bill does at the most basic level is says that if you have new evidence, and it's truly new evidence, which means it couldn't have been discovered previously through the exercise of reasonable diligence, and it supports an otherwise valid claim for relief, you get your day in court. You get a shot. You still have to prove your case to go home, to get out of prison, but you get that chance, a chance that's denied too many people today. And we do our current standard is an outlier, as Justice Frazier mentioned. We're the most restrictive state in the Midwest, one of the most restrictive in the country. You know, I litigated an untimely post-conviction claim in Mississippi last year. The standard there is easier than here in Minnesota. It's easier for me to litigate a newly discovered evidence claim in Mississippi than in Minnesota. And I have nothing against the state of Mississippi, but that should not be the case. So I have a visual, on this we've listed the states of the Midwest along with the federal system in terms of from least restrictive on the far left here to most restrictive on the far right. Now we have a number of states in the Midwest that don't even have statutes of limitations for post-conviction claims, Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio. A number of states do with varying degrees.
Mr. Marquardt, do you have this available to email to folks so we can I just want to make sure we have time for Mr. Haynes to testify.
I will make it available.
Okay, great.
So very briefly, I mean, Minnesota is over at the far most restrictive. At its most basic, we're trying to take Minnesota and essentially slot it in here around South Dakota and make it more in keeping with sort of the mainstream of how this issue is treated in other jurisdictions. So with that, I thank you again. I hope you'll support this bill, and I'm happy to stand by for any questions you may have.
All right.
Thank you.
Next on the list, we have Marvin Haynes. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee. My name is Marvin Haynes, and I'm here in support of the House File 2400. In December of last year, I was exonerated for a crime I did not commit. When I was 16 years old, I was arrested for and eventually convicted of murder. And building a case against me, the state used unconstitutional eyewitness identification techniques, even though I did not match the eyewitness description of the perpetrator. Ultimately, I spent nearly 20 years in prison for a crime which I was innocent. The only reason I'm able to testify in front of you today is because the Hennepin County Attorney's Office took the unusual steps of waiving the 2-year statute of limitation and enabled me to get my day in court. Without that waiver, I would be still sitting in prison for something I didn't do. While I was wrongly incarcerated, I missed out on 20 years of freedom and life. I lost family members, and I was not able to say goodbye or attend funerals. My mother experienced a stroke and lost her abilities to speak while I was still awaiting justice. Had this language in Minnesota post-conviction statutes been what it is being proposed today, I might have had a shot at justice years ago. Maybe I would have been able to spend time with my mom before she lost her abilities to communicate or say goodbye to loved ones I lost. Instead, I was fighting for freedom and waiting for justice. Since getting out, I've been experiencing a lot of things for the first time. I'm living real life. I'm spending time with my family and friends. I got a job. I applied for license. I have major plans that happen. Other people that's fighting for, you know, innocence. So I just want to use my experience being wrongly convicted to make sure that nobody else had to experience the same injustice that I did. That's why I'm here today. So there are other people like me sitting in prison awaiting for justice. There are more Marvin Hanks, but without change in our law, they will continue to wait and miss out on life important moments. And our community will miss out on their gifts and contributions. Please support House File 2400 and ensure that ensure that not only one more Minnesotans has to wait a day longer for their rightful freedom. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm deeply sorry that this happened to you and to your family. Withholding a person's liberty is not something any of us should take lightly, and this should not have happened to you, and I really thank you for advocating for others and advocating on this issue. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Are there other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? All right. Seeing none, we will move on to member discussion. Representative Pinky.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. Thank you, Representative Frazier, for bringing this bill. Thank you, Mr. Marquardt, for your work on this, and Mr. Haynes for coming here to share your story today. Like the chair said, it is the state of Minnesota that is responsible for what happened to the last 20 years of your life, and I want us to make sure we have a moment to take ownership of that wrong, and thank Representative Frazier for this bill, because this bill is an obviously moral good that we can do. We don't always have such an obviously good thing that we get to do when we come into this job, and this is just so clearly right that I'm very excited to vote for it. Obviously, it would be even better if we never wrongfully convicted anyone for crimes that they didn't commit, but if we do that, and we know that we do, we need to have every tool at our disposal to correct those wrongs immediately. So I just want to thank you all for being here. Mr. Haynes, it's an honor to have you here with us today.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. And this is to the bill's author or one of his testifiers. And I agree that what happened to you is a travesty of justice. And I'm glad it worked out for you to have your freedom back, right? I mean, that's wonderful. I have just some technical questions about the language changes to kind of understand the difference between clear and convincing, that standard, and the new language, which I think would read, provides facts necessary to sustain one or more legally cognizable claims for post-conviction relief. And if you could parse that out for myself, who I am a non-lawyer, and members of the public that are mostly non-lawyers as well.
Vice Chair Frazier, or Mr. Marquardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. So the idea here is that if you have to have new facts, and they have to be the sort of core facts that go to support a claim for relief. And it depends on what there's various claims that you might bring in post-conviction. There is an actual newly discovered claim in terms of the substantive claim for relief. There's claims based on false evidence. There's ineffective assistance of counsel. There's a Brady claim. That's kind of your core sort of four post-conviction claims. So whatever the claim is that you're bringing, you have to have new facts that sort of establish the basic facts necessary to prove that substantive claim, whatever that claim is. So another way to put it, and this might resonate more with the lawyers in the room, but you have to have like the core facts that you would need to survive a motion to dismiss, that sort of set the facts to satisfy the basic elements of whatever the claim is. And if you do, that's enough to get through the statute of limitations, even if those facts arose more than 2 years after the fact. Again, assuming they couldn't have been discovered previously with due diligence. That is a pretty significant limitation. If you could have known this earlier and you just sort of sat on your rights, then unfortunately, you know, you're still out of luck. But if you couldn't have found it until later and it supports a claim, then you get through the statute of limitations.
I will say, too, my reading of it is that adding the legally cognizable, you know, it can't just be any sort of claim. It has to be based in statute and law, and there has to be an actual legal reason why you're asking for the relief, if I'm reading that correctly as well. You're nodding. Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's it.
All right. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say thank you to Representative Frazier and Mr. Marquardt for working on this during the interim. I know I had some concerns with the language last year when this bill was brought, and I know that you worked carefully with the County Attorneys Association. I mean, the reality is there are claims that are getting excluded that should be resulting in at least a post-conviction hearing. You know, we do know there are a lot of people who file for relief that the claims are meritless or there's no good reason for the delay. And so I think that the language now as drafted really tries to hone in on those cases that do warrant getting back into court again. So again, just want to say thank you for your work on it. And I also understand that perhaps the County Attorneys Association wants an extended timeline for being able to respond to those claims, because again, there are a lot of petitions that are filed, many of which are pro se, and they can take a lot of time to respond to, especially if it's an attorney assigned to the case who wasn't the one who tried the case or even handled the direct appeal. And my understanding is that you're both amenable to that suggestion. So I guess that's my question, is if you're willing to consider that amendment in the next stop. Thank you.
Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Mueller. Yes, we are amenable to that, and we will be bringing that amendment in the next stop.
All right. Seeing nobody else on the list, Representative Frazier, closing comments.
Thanks for the discussion, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Haynes, for being here. Thank you, Mr. McCourt, for your work on this on behalf of Mr. Haynes in this particular issue. And I think I'll just end with what Rep. Finke said. This is a bill to do good, so let's vote yes and do good.
Yeah, thank you, Vice Chair Frazier. And I also want to thank Mr. Haynes again and just acknowledge there's no words that we can say in this committee to give you back the time that you should have had. And I know most of us, if not all of us, don't take it lightly. Although we send people to prison every day in this state, that it's not something we should take lightly. And so I just want to acknowledge the gravity of what happened to you. With that, Vice Chair Frazier renews his motion that House File 2400, as amended, be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The bill is on its way. We will see everybody on Thursday. With that, we are adjourned.